Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We're welcoming back one of our earliest podcast guests. I think that Peter Wehner might have been on in the first week of the Bulwark Podcast, or certainly the second week. So, Peter, very good to have you back again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Charlie. It's always great to be on the podcast. It's one of my favorites. So thanks for having me again.
Well, the most important thing that we're going to talk about today, and the thing I'm going to get the most reaction on, Peter, I have to just give you the heads up on this, is the fact that I finished season four of Shetland last night, and it is absolutely awesome. And so I want to thank everybody that gave me that suggestion. We've sort of been going through the Bill Kristol / audience suggestions for shows to binge watch: Broadchurch, Hinterland, just finished Shetland. There's another season coming, but I also will say that I'm on the side. My thing on the side is watching the British cop show called In the Line of Duty, the Line of Duty, which is too intense for my wife, so I have to watch that on my own. It is really awesome. It is, although for people who are not into dark cynicism, probably not the thing for you. If you're looking for something feel good, or see, I have this weird thing, Peter, where sometimes watching really dark, you know, dystopian type things makes reality look less awful. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I understand the tropism toward watching the dark to make the current circumstances better than they are.
Well, speaking of dystopian, right before we started, I mentioned, you know, our daily dose of dystopian polls. You've seen, and I know you've commented on this, the poll that finds that 53% of Republicans believe that Donald Trump is still the president, or say that. So, you know, with all the caveats that people may say all kinds of stuff to pollsters because they're positioning, I mean, we are in a world that is like whatever you thought things were going to be. You sort of like move the Overton window of dystopia, you know, one step over. So what do you make of the fact that 53% of Republicans tell pollsters not just that Donald Trump won the election, not just they believe the big lie, but they think he's still president?
Yeah, it's really disturbing, but it's not surprising. I mean, this is the world that Donald Trump helped create, and the Republican Party that decided to throw its hat over the wall with him very early on. And, you know, this is a world that I'm sure Donald Trump is happy to have created. I imagine that some of the Republicans who have been complicit in this probably have mixed feelings about it, but this is what they did. This is the road that they've chosen. And this is what happens if you repeat a lie over and over and over again. I think that a lot of Republicans thought that they could get away with this. They didn't think it was real, but it would feed the base and the anger of the base. And then once Trump left office, things would snap back. That's not how life works. That's not how the human mind works. The other thing I'd say, Charlie, is that there are some conspiracy theories that people can believe in, UFOs and other things, that are odd, but not pernicious. This is odd and pernicious because this is internalizing a certain view of the world and the political world that can catalyze a lot of very dangerous stuff, including violence, which we've seen and which I fear that we're going to see more of. And this is a lie that goes to the heart of self-government and of democracy. So this isn't just any other conspiracy theory to embrace. This one is a very, very dangerous one.
Okay, that's exactly what I wanted to talk to you about. You had the piece in The Atlantic last week, Trump is marching down the road to political violence. And I know that people, you know, might think, okay, we've heard this before, we've had these warnings before, but I guess, and I think you probably feel the same way, you want to sort of put a line under it and say, no, this is real, this is really dangerous. You know, we kind of probably should have understood the trajectory of events over the last 5 years, but it's really, really clear now. So, well, let's talk about this, because you're talking about the prospect of more and even greater violence, and that it's embedded in this mindset. And I mentioned to you earlier when we were chatting before we started, what I thought was really powerful in your piece in The Atlantic was your description of the mindset in MAGA world, which I think is really important for people to understand. And a lot of our listeners may think they know what's going on here, but I think you did a really good job of trying to get inside the heads of MAGA folks and then explain why it's dangerous. So first of all, so what is the mindset? What's going on? How is this lie playing in their heads?
Yeah, thanks. It's an important question, because I think if we don't understand that, we really don't know what we're dealing with, and we may not be fully alert to the dangers. You know, the way that I describe the mindset of MAGA world is that they believe, because they've been told, that they're victims of a monstrous injustice. So when Donald Trump sends out statements saying that they were victims of the crime of the century, we may hear that as the ravings of a 74-year-old sociopath in Mar-a-Lago who crashes wedding parties and dismiss it. And I understand that temptation. That's not how they hear it. What they're hearing is that a leader that they revered was removed from office by illegitimate means, and that this is one of the great crimes, democratic crimes, in history. And it was perpetrated by people who want to destroy them and destroy their children and to destroy their world. So they've been cheated out of power. And so they then begin to think, well, what are the weapons at our disposal to undo this grave injustice? And the reality is that for some of them, violence is there. I don't think for most of them, well, I'm certain for most of them, it's not the first choice that they would reach for. It's not what they would prefer, but they believe that sometimes violence is necessary as a recourse to undo grave injustice. That's why when you hear references to the American Revolution and so forth, again, some people will hear that, a lot of people will hear that and think these are just sort of tinfoil nuts, you know, that imagining themselves as soldiers in the new American Revolution. But that's how they see themselves. And we know, by the way, from many, many statements at this point of the people who were part of the insurrection on January 6th, that that's what they said. They said that the president invited me here. They believe they were doing their patriotic duty. So that's the kind of mindset that we're dealing with. And that, I think, is why it's a particularly dangerous period. I'll say one other thing, Charlie, which is I just think it's important. Because a lot of critics of Trump and Trump supporters, and I am and you are, I don't think they actually talk to Trump supporters or listen to them. And I've had conversations, as I'm sure you've had, with people who are Trump supporters, but also to read the accounts of people and to understand that. Last thing I'll say on this point is that there's disturbing polling evidence, and Daniel Cox at the American Enterprise Institute, which of course is a conservative think tank, found there was an alarmingly high number of Republicans who believe that violence may be something of a resort that Trump supporters need to reach to undo this what they perceive as injustice.
So this is not just anecdotal. I mean, there is polling data that would suggest that this is widespread. And okay, so you know, you went through in your article and just now you went through this mindset and conclude this is how the road to political violence is paved. And I want to stick with this point because, and I don't want to be misunderstood, but if you understand this thought process, what they have been told, what they believe, it's a coherent worldview. It actually is logically consistent, right? If in fact you believe that the country is under siege, that this great crime has been committed by people who want to destroy you, who hate you, who are dismantling this country, then why would you not look at the possibility of using extreme measures? And you know, I think I've done this before on the podcast, but I would encourage people to just try. Imagine, you know, if it was the other way around, what would you be prepared to do? And I think that's the kind of thing that if you put yourself in this position, you start to realize that violence is not an irrational response. And I'm not defending this. I'm just saying why this is so real, that each one of these lies that we keep talking about feed into this narrative. And Peter, at this point, we can't really be in denial that there are consequences to these ideas, can we?
That's exactly right. I mean, we saw this play out, of course, on January 6th with the insurrection, lethal insurrection on the Capitol. But that was such a shock to the system that I think a lot of people understandably thought, look, this has never happened before. It'll never happen again. This is kind of a one-off. And let's hope it is. My concern is that we see the links in this violent chain that are in place. You have the lie itself, the pernicious lie, the repetition of the lie, and a lie that has roots. So that's one. The second thing that you have is an existential fear, this sense that we talked about, which is if they win, then almost everything that we know and love will be destroyed. So there is a deep sort of commitment to a dark narrative, a catastrophizing mindset that is at place. By the way, one of the reasons or one of the tip-offs of that catastrophizing mindset is if you have conversations with people, say on abortion, as I have had, pro-life people who are part of MAGA world, and you point out to them that the number of abortions is the lowest number since before Roe v. Wade, and that the number of abortions and the rate and the ratio have gone down steadily for 20 years, whether it's a Republican or Democratic president, regardless of the composition of the Supreme Court, you would think that that point would bring some degree of celebration, not that they think the struggle is over, but that at least massive progress has been made. But that's not the reaction you get. Because that is good news that runs against what their mindset. And for them, it creates a kind of cognitive dissonance so they block it out. So there's that. That's the second one, which is this existential fear, the sense that the culture is absolutely under assault. And then the third, a third link in this chain is a deep hatred for the other side. And both sides have this. This is what scientists refer to affective polarization, where basically the hatred for the other side is more intense than the loyalty and affection that you have for your own side. And so you have this mindset. So we have the polling evidence and we have the precedent of the sixth. And you have these people who have constructed, as you said, a kind of connected dots world, given their flawed and malicious premises that will lead them to where they are. And we do know from these conversations with people who stormed the Capitol on the 6th, if you gave them sodium pentothal, they would absolutely say what they were doing was a patriotic act, and they were following the lead of their commander in chief, Donald Trump. So this is as I said, this is dangerous stuff. I hope I'm wrong, and I'm not necessarily predicting widespread violence. I just think we need to take it more seriously than a lot of people have and understand what's underneath all of this that's driving it.
Well, I don't think you're wrong. So one of the things that our critics would say or have said about us in the past is that we keep saying the same thing over and over and over again. And I'm sure you've had this feeling like, okay, I'm writing this column. I've written this column 50 times about the danger of Trump, about what it's doing to the country. So I guess the question is, can we disaggregate this a little bit? What's new and what's old? You and I have been in that small group who've been arguing since he came down the golden escalator that Donald Trump posed a real threat to American democratic norms. So we've written that. We wrote that in 2015, 2016, 17, 18, 19, 20. What's different in 21? Or is it just basically us saying we told you so?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Yeah, and in disagreeing, I'd say there are certain things. One is, you know, as writers and commentators, I think this is probably your philosophy too. What we're supposed to do is to speak the truth as best we understand it, and try to be faithful to that. It doesn't mean that we have answers to all of the problems. It doesn't mean that we think that our warnings will be heeded. It doesn't mean a lot of things. What it does mean is that you try with as much honesty and integrity as you can to try and speak to the moment and try and alert people to what's going on. Whether people accept those cautions, and believe in those critiques, you know, that's up to them. In terms of what is different, I don't think we've reached an inflection point, but I do think that something is happening that not enough people are aware of. And that is that while Republican identification with Trump personally is less than it has been in the past, which is inevitable. I mean, he's not president. He's off of social media. Republicans are not identifying any less with the kinds of conspiracy and anti-democratic impulses that have been associated with Trump in the past 5 years. And the worry is that those impulses are becoming key to Republican self-identity independent of Trump.
Yes.
And that is not a good thing. Basically, the poisons were unleashed, and even with Trump receding from the picture and off the stage, it's going on, and that is just a different level it's a different level of threat. Obviously, having Trump as president created its own set of problems because he was sociopathic and he had more power than anybody in the world. So, getting him out was essential.
And you're right. And I think that that's the analysis that I've been sort of wrestling with, because I do think that what we've seen happen since January 6th does feel like it's something new. And I think, you know, you put your finger on it when you said we're headed down the road to violence. Maybe it was theoretical before, but 5 years of marinating in lies and outrage and division has a consequence. It has a consequence to the moral fabric of the country, of people, that we, in a certain sense, I think that we have become addicted to the dopamine hit of outrage and division, so that even though he's gone, it's not gotten better, it's gotten worse. And I do think that what's new is what you describe, this widespread acceptance of all or nothing, a form of politics that might lead to violence. And people need to understand this, that sometimes I think that sometimes people sort of shut off, like, okay, you know, all those people on the right, they're all crazy, they're all bad, they're all racist, so therefore we put that in the box. But it is evolving, and things are turning uglier at a very rapid pace.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's actually very well stated, which is, I do think that there's an addictive quality to this. I think it's a psychologically addictive quality. And, you know, there are psychological addictions, like there are physiological addictions. And what is it about an addiction that you have to understand? It is that there is a craving in people to whether it's drugs or cigarettes or alcohol, where the body craves to have those things. And you can get these kind of psychological addictions where, as you said, it's a sort of a dopamine rush. I mean, they've done studies. Brain science is actually quite helpful here. So we have some sense of what's happening in these people's, you know, mindsets. The other thing that is important to do, and I know you have done this over time, is one has to disaggregate among Trump supporters. I mean, there are the really hardcore ones, the ones who've committed violence and who are absolutely unreachable. And then there are some number of people who are leaning in that direction, or they feel like they're Trump supporters because they really despise the left, but they're just not as far gone. So there's a spectrum, and you know, when you're thinking about what to do about that world, MAGA world, you know, there are different strategies to reach different people, or in some cases, there are people who are simply beyond reach.
Yeah, I mean, so some of them are just simply transactional, and you saw some of the non-true believers stick their heads up above the parapet briefly after January 6th. You had that moment when it seemed like Kevin McCarthy had a moment of lucidity or courage or whatever, Mitch McConnell. And then, of course, they all went back to normal. So talk to me a little bit about Liz Cheney and your take on her, because it has been extraordinary watching her. how unbending she's been. And now she's under fire from both the left and the right. Justin Amash is saying, hey, she shouldn't be a hero. She should have spoken out earlier, which obviously has, you know, some truth to it. She's being attacked on the left because she refused to say in the interview over the weekend that she opposed the voter bills taking place in the state. So give me, what are you thinking about Liz Cheney and her position right now?
Yeah, I worked with Liz in the George W. Bush administration, and I admire her. I don't always agree with her, and I actually did have disagreements with her during the Trump presidency, because she was one of the people that I wish had spoken out sooner and louder. And I think that Mitt Romney is really the person who has been the most impressive throughout the Trump presidency, because he spoke out earlier and louder than anybody else. He cast the vote for impeachment and all the rest. Having said that, I think Liz Cheney has been outstanding and been almost a heroic figure, or at least not a heroic necessarily, but a very courageous figure. I think for her, it was relatively simple, which is that what happened first on November 3rd, which was the refusal to accept the election results, and certainly what happened on January 6th with the insurrection, was just a bright line that he crossed, where she said, this cannot go on. And I think for her, it's part of her philosophy of American government and self-government, and her roots with her family, deep ties to the institution of Congress, the American system of government, checks and balances, and a sense of what is morally and ethically right. And the Cheneys, if they believe something is morally and ethically right or wrong, they'll say it and they'll stand up for it. And to have that kind of backbone, that kind of courage, has been so manifestly lacking in the Republican Party for the last 5 years. Should she have spoken out earlier? You know, I wish she had. But this is such an important moment, and it really has, whether you like what she's said in the past or not, I just think that you have to acknowledge her courage and this moment. And I think if liberals or conservatives who have been Trump critics don't celebrate what she's done and don't stand with her and don't support her, they're making a huge error, because this is a moment unlike any other moment, because the events of January 6th were unlike any other event. And she is speaking the truth in unvarnished ways, and you need people to do that. Other people can do other things. They can maybe work more behind the scenes. But you need people like Liz Cheney to speak the truth, speak truth to power, to be unwavering, and also, quite frankly, Charlie, to inspire other people who have been saying this, because she is a someone who is in Congress, and she does have a public platform. So I think she's been great, and I hope she stays at it.
Yeah, and Adam Kinzinger as well, who you've written about.
Yeah, he's been terrific as well.
And my advice to people on the left who are nitpicking is, if you think this is an existential threat, act like it. Okay, so let's talk about a couple of other things that are happening now in terms of the real ugly divisions that may not have anything to do directly with Donald Trump. Today is the anniversary of the death of George Floyd, and so there's a lot of discussion about how that's affected the country. I mentioned a little bit earlier, there's this really kind of disturbing poll, this Axios Ipsos poll, America 1 year after George Floyd, and shows this massive divide about the state of race relations, about equal rights, not between white and black Americans, but between white Republicans and white Democrats. So here's one of the questions, Peter. Our country has made the change. Do you agree with this? That our country has already made all the changes needed to give black Americans equal rights with white Americans. We've done enough. 79% of white Republicans say we've already done enough. Compared to white Democrats, 12%. So there is really a sense right now, among on the right. And you see this in the debate over critical race theory and a lot of other things. We really are seeing a moment where the attitudes toward racial equality, racial equity all of these things are really polarized. And I get the sense that that's being exploited as well.
Yeah, I completely agree. I completely agree with you. It just seems like, Charlie, to a degree beyond anything I've ever experienced, I'd say first, politics is invading almost every nook and cranny of American life, including Bible studies and churches and, you know, book clubs, just across the board. Yeah, so it's invading everything. And the second thing that it's doing is making it very, very difficult to have honest and real discussions about issues. Now, that's always been difficult in politics because of the nature of politics. But everything is so tribalistic now that things have to be all or nothing, and it's all zero sum. So let's take the issue of race. And my own views on this is aligned, I suppose, with Barack Obama and others, which is that we've made tremendous progress from where we have been. But we were at an awful point, whether it was slavery or segregation, and the laws passed, and that was important. But attitudes don't always change, and there's residual racism that exists in this country. It existed in the Republican Party to a degree that I had not anticipated. I think both of us knew that there were fringe elements in the Republican Party and in the country at large were racist. But it turned out that racial appeals had a lot more traction than I knew about. And in terms of the issue of race itself, it seems like it's just hard to have the position, which is we've made progress, and that the left needs to be careful with the 1619 Project and right. The charges of, you know, promiscuous charges of systematic racism and what that means. And it can exist in certain institutions, but it can go too far. And people who are white and are on the right, you know, they hear those charges and they get riled up. And their response is that there's not a problem at all, when I think there is clearly and manifestly a problem that is going on, and that we still have to grapple with this issue. It's not as acute as it was in the past, but it is still deeply problematic. The other thing I'll say, Charlie, is, you know, my views have evolved on this. I wrote a piece. It was actually when I was blogging for Commentary in 2014. And it was, I think the precipitating event was the Cliven Bundy event issues in the West. And there were manifestations of racism and charges of racism and some congressional aides, I think for Rand Paul or for his father. In any event, I wrote a piece in which I admitted that I had thought that racism had receded more than it had, and that I, as a white person, had a certain perspective on life, and it was very different than if I had a black experience. And if you were a black person in America today, the racism that you would encounter, the slights that you would encounter, the obstacles that you would encounter are real and they exist. And we have to acknowledge that and to try and overcome that. But a lot of people who are white, by virtue of their experience, their life experience, those incidents are foreign to them. And so they think that it's just done and over, that this, you know, 64 and 65 right. legislation on voting rights and on civil rights basically took care of it, and everything right. is fine. And if we just stopped talking about racism, things would be much better. And I just don't think that's true. And the George Floyd incident, which happened a year ago, the tragedy and the ugliness and the awfulness of that incident underscored some deeper reality that exists that we can't ignore.
So that was the consensus on the right, that we had dealt with all of this and it was time to move on. I mean, I think that was kind of the broad consensus. It underlay a lot of the opposition to things like affirmative action. And then, of course, you have these shocks like what's been happening with George Floyd and other things, including maybe a deeper understanding of history. I've talked about the Tulsa Race Massacre several times on this podcast. But what I see happening right now is on the right, at a moment when I think it would really behoove us to go and re-examine our positions on all of this and where we stand and whether or not there is a principled conservative approach to equity and equality and justice on all these. But that debate is being shut down. You turn on Fox and they've gone to the basically gone to the narrative or the memes that any discussion of race can be dismissed as critical race theory or woke or being, white, liberal guilt. You're seeing themes on Fox News about the great replacement theory that I never imagined that I would see in the mainstream of the conservative. I mean, you and I both knew there were the Pat Buchanans out there. We always knew that they were there. But now they're feeling emboldened. And I think that that's the real tragedy, because it tells me that that Republicans and people on the right are just simply not going to move on this issue. They are not going to engage in the kind of introspection and the kind of discussion and the kinds of policy debates that they need to have, because you have the demagogues that shut it down. And you're seeing this in the polling, that people just don't want white Republicans just, don't want to talk about race issues in America anymore.
Yeah, I entirely agree. And indeed, the polling shows that whites, at least white Republicans, feel like the discrimination is more pointed against them than African Americans and other people. So they believe that now they are the objects of racial discrimination, yeah. Which plays into this larger phenomenon, which we've talked about before, which is the mindset of grievance, resentment, and victimization on the right. And I think, I remember years ago where you were speaking out about this in the 90s. This was pretty common within the conservative world, which was this notion of the victimization mentality on the left. And yes. We who were conservatives really were pretty tough on that. The degree to which people on the right now, and Donald Trump is really the epitome of that, who are constantly whining and complaining and feel like they're victims. And the coiled anger that's based on this sense of grievance and resentment, it's difficult to overstate it. We could really make progress on this issue. And the reality is that African Americans in this country have had a terrible deal from the beginning. They still face real obstacles. And this is America's original sin, and we haven't gotten over it. But right now, you've got these figures like Tucker Carlson, who I think is clearly the most important and malicious figure on Fox News and in the right-wing media ecosystem. And as you said, this white replacement theory, and I mean, every week he is almost, it has to be intentional, is saying things that are more and more outrageous and dangerous and provocative. And that is feeding this mindset that we've been discussing. So the synergy that's happening between or among the base of the party, the media, and lawmakers in the Republican Party, it's just a very dangerous mix.
Well, I want to get to the upsurge of anti-Semitic violence in just a moment, but because maybe it's obligatory, we have to mention Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'm saying that sarcastically, but I noticed that this morning she's doubling down on her Nazi Holocaust comparison between masking and vaccines. She tweeted out, "Vaccinated employees get a vaccination logo just like the Nazis forced Jewish people to wear a gold star. Vaccine passports, mask mandates create discrimination against unvaxxed people, blah, blah, blah." So she's doubling down on this Nazi comparison. We could talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene, endlessly, and the way she's being tolerated in the Republican Party. But it does strike me that for a large class of Americans, the only moral standard that they know is Nazis. What I mean? It's sort of the impoverishment of our moral language, yeah. that everything I don't like is Hitler, because we're so uncomfortable in making other moral, ethical arguments.
Yeah. Yeah, I entirely agree. I just think that the Nazi analogy shouldn't be used except in the most extreme circumstances. And I quite agree with you. It's because people know so little about history that seems to be the historical analogy that that they reach for. I do want to say one thing about Marjorie Taylor Greene, because I agree with you, but I also would add a caveat. She's clearly a person with a diseased mind. She's not well. And she sees her role as to provoke people. And she says these insane things. And I understand the argument of people who say, like Damon Linker and others, who say basically don't pay attention to her. Mm-hmm. That's the oxygen that she wants. So I get that. On the other hand, I think that it is important to take a step back and realize what is happening. I mean, this person is as crazy a member of Congress as there's probably ever been in American history. She is more popular with the base and the leadership of the Republican Party than Liz Cheney is.
Much more, yeah.
And she raised over $3 million in the first quarter of this year for her reelection campaign, which is a stunningly high figure, especially for a freshman member of Congress, especially for one who isn't on any committees. And so we have to take a step back from time to time and not get inured to just how insane this moment is and how dangerous it is. The fact that a person like this saying these things, you know, and after the Jewish space lasers and the QAnon conspiracy theories and all the rest, that she is basically a Republican in good standing, and that the leadership can't call her out, that they're too afraid to call her out, underscores what a diseased and dangerous party the Republican Party is right now. So, you know, she's a nut, but she's a prominent nut.
No, and to this argument that we should just ignore these people and not give them oxygen, my response is we tried that, and how did it work out? Because I've been there over the years. I think you have as well. That we knew these people were out there and decided not to spend any time calling them out or stigmatizing them or maybe even purging them. We rolled our eyes, you know, knew they were in the corner. But they were our allies. And so we kind of went along with, you know, as long as they were going to vote our same way, we're not going to pick a fight with them. And I think that turned out to be a disastrous miscalculation. So silence, we've already tried that. Let's pretend they don't exist. Let's not amplify them. Because frankly, it doesn't matter. I mean, at this point, she's going to be amplified, whatever you and I do, whatever Damon Linker does. She's going to be able to, you know, speak to the base, raise a lot of money from the base. So the question is, what do people like, you know, who are in a position to sound the alarm do? Are we supposed to stand down, not push back? I think that's a total moral abdication.
Yeah, no, I think that's well said. I'd be interested, Charlie, we can go on to the anti-Semitism.
Yeah, yeah.
I do want to speak to that. But what at this point, at this juncture, so here we are in sort of in late May, when you think about what to do to repair the Republican Party, not necessarily that you think that it could happen, but if you, somebody said, look, you know, if Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney called you and said, this may not work, but tell us what the levers are here. What do we need to do or what do we need to say? Maybe that's different than what we've been doing and saying, that gives us the best chance of salvaging the Republican Party, which is essential for the party and for the country, because as both of us know, it's essential that there be a healthy conservative party in the country. What would you tell them? What do you think are the levers there? What changes do you think need to be made, if any?
Well, I am, as a fan of Don Quixote, I'm in favor of tilting at windmills, but I also understand what tilting at windmills means. I do hope that courage is contagious, that making these principle stands, that has a wider audience than there might be apparent right now. But I'm at the moment, Peter, thinking that it's unrealistic to think that the Republican Party is going to be salvaged anytime soon, no matter what they do. However, see, this is the question. Do you make that final hopeless principled stand knowing that you might lose, but because, you know, this is where you stand and you can't do anything else, which seems to be Liz Cheney's position. You know, she was asked by Jonathan Swan, why do you think you can fix the Republican Party? And her answer was, well, because I'm doing this because I think that it's right. I don't know that you can go beyond that. I don't have an answer better than that.
Yeah. Now that's an impressive answer. It's an honest answer, and maybe one can't. But at any moment in time, all people can do is do what they think is right and to be faithful to the causes that they care about, and let the chips fall where they may. And then you try and be prudent and strategic in terms of making those arguments. I suppose if in the end if the wreckage can be repaired, it's going to require probably events to change. And maybe it's simply the case that the Republican Party has to lose and lose and lose, like the Labour Party in the United Kingdom from the late 70s to the early 90s, the Democratic Party, from Carter McGovern to Dukakis. And that created an opening for Tony Blair and Bill Clinton to really make reforms. And it may well be that the Republican Party, because it wasn't wiped out in 2020, there are just not enough people who are convinced that this is Trumpism and staying with Trump is a losing proposition. And they may well believe that with Trump and Trumpism is a losing proposition.
Now, I heard somewhere that a political party needs to lose 3 consecutive elections before it's willing to rethink its position, and I don't know that we are there yet. So, Peter, we started talking about the danger of political violence on the right. Let's wrap up with the actual violence we're experiencing right now. And again, this is it's new and it's old. Anti-Semitic violence is not a new thing in this country. However, it appears in the last several days, several weeks, to have really spiked the number of incidents of people targeting Jews. And there does seem to be a difficulty among some of our progressive friends in calling out there. It's easy to call out anti-Semitism on the right, like Charlottesville. It's a little bit more awkward for some of them to call out anti-Semitism on the left. Your thoughts about what's happening right now?
Yeah, it's really disturbing to me. I mean, we've seen anti-Semitism, of course, historically. It was spreading throughout Europe in the last decade. There were real signs that this was trouble. It's been something that we've been blessedly free of more or less in the United States, but that is now ending. I think what I would say is that the very critique that the left makes of the right needs to be made of the left too, which is words have consequences and words shape moral sensibilities. And there are things that are being said about Israel and about Jewish people that are shaping moral sensibilities and giving sort of a license for people now to use violence against people who are Jewish. This is not a one-way street. If you dehumanize people, there are consequences to that. I will say, just to take a step back, I view what's happening in the Democratic Party with alarm as it relates to Israel. I've been a strong defender of Israel from almost as long as I can remember being interested in politics, and never understanding what I perceived as a kind of double standard on the left against them. I certainly am open to and understand if there are particular policies that people agree with, or particular prime ministers in Israel that people disagree with. But in my estimation, the moral equivalence between Israel and Hamas is morally off the rails, and that Israel, given the circumstances that it faces and the real existential hatred that's directed at the Jewish state, they've acted astonishing prudence for the most part and care. If you have a terrorist state that's shooting missiles at you thousands at a time, you're going to respond. Again, that doesn't mean that there aren't particular issues, whether they're the settlements or housing or others, that people could take issue with. But I think the Democratic Party is, or at least elements of the Democratic Party, certainly the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, is becoming, I think, almost anti-Israel in its reflexes. And that, that worries me, and that has consequences.
Yeah, I think Joe Biden continues to get it right, but you're right. The trend is troubling. Okay, so you want to do some punditry in real time?
Sure.
Okay, so even as you probably haven't seen this, even as we have been speaking, Kevin McCarthy has emerged from his bunker and issued a statement condemning Marjorie Taylor Greene's comments. He said comparing the masks to the Holocaust. This is what he said. Marjorie is wrong, and her intentional decision to compare the horrors of the Holocaust with wearing masks is appalling. The Holocaust is the greatest atrocity committed in history. The fact that this needs to be stated today is deeply troubling. Let me be clear. The House Republican Conference condemns this language. So that sounds good. But we've seen this before, haven't we, Peter? I mean, the question is, will the base rally around Marjorie Taylor Greene, or are we beginning to see her being more isolated?
Yeah, I think we just have to let this play out, because we saw with Kevin McCarthy after January 6th, he was critical of Donald Trump. Look, one thing we know about Kevin McCarthy is that he's a weather vane. He's a person of astonishing weakness. He has no spine, and he's hyper ambitious. So if he's doing this, if it's the right thing to do, it's only incidentally right, because he thinks it's in his interest and the interest of his caucus. It's not driven by moral considerations. I think that's a fair statement to make about Kevin McCarthy. The only thing and I'm glad he's saying this, I hope he continues to say it. I guess what I'd say in response to Mr. McCarthy is, could you be as clear on the insurrection of January 6th as you are with Marjorie Taylor Greene? Because that was a bigger moment than this, as horrible as what she's saying. These are the words of a person who's obviously, as we've talked about, not psychologically well. January 6th was an insurrection in an effort to cause a coup, and it was violent. And it was unprecedented. And the fact that Kevin McCarthy is basically trying to push this down a memory hole and opposing a commission to look into what really happened and has gone silent or worse on this, I mean, that's the real tell. So if you can speak out against Marjorie Taylor Greene about these awful comments, fine. But let's see that similar kind of courage when it comes to January 6th. I can almost guarantee you're not going to see it.
See, I wonder whether he had actually gotten permission from the Orange Versailles in order to be able to say this. But with McCarthy, I think this is the key. Is like, good for him criticizing and repudiating Marjorie Taylor Greene, but give it a couple days. Let's see where we are 24 hours from now, 48 hours from now. What does the right rally around? Where do the anti-Trumpers come down on all of this? It'll be interesting to see. Peter Wehner, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it very much. By the way, I strongly recommend Peter's article from The Atlantic, Trump is Marching Down the Road to Political Violence. You can find it in The Atlantic or online. Peter, thanks for coming back.
Thanks a lot, Charlie. Take care.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.